Welcome to Victims and Villains. We are your Marvel correspondents from Victims and Villains, and you have to watch this podcast. I'm Alan.
I'm Josh. How's it going, buddy?
Pretty good. Very exciting Marvel weekend for me here. Picked up a expansion for the Marvel deck building game, Marvel Legendary, over the weekend before I saw Thor. So I had to come home to play with. And then when I got home from the theater, my picture disc vinyl for the Spider-Man No Way Home soundtrack was waiting for me. So I put that on the turntable immediately. So pretty
very
good time.
Nice. Very nice.
How have you been?
I've been good. It was a busy weekend. I was able to get some stuff done. I'm in crunch mode right now for a couple projects. Work is busy. Mm-hmm. I had a busy day today. I haven't done energy drinks in a long time. Really, I think since last time I saw you, I really only go out and get a C4 when I'm like in crunch mode. And I took one today and I got a lot of stuff done. But I'm just going like a mile a minute right now. But I have been needing to talk to you about this film. I saw it opening day, and then my mom wanted me to take it. She's take her to it. She's a big mm-hmm. Chris Hemsworth fan, and it's been hard. It's been hard not to talk about it. I'm ready.
We are here to fix that. So we will be talking about the film spoiler-free for the first chunk of the episode. When we get into spoilers, we will let you know, either with an audio cue or if you're watching us on Twitch, with the spoiler alert. So without further ado, let's talk Thor 4, Love and Thunder. Or as I want to call it, The Revengers 2, Electric Boogaloo. So I like it. So this is Taika Waititi's return to the Thor franchise. What did you think?
This is the first Marvel character to get a fourth film.
Yes.
So that's a big deal.
Yeah.
Sorry, I cut you off. What were you going to say?
What are your overall thoughts of the film? Because I know a little bit, but I'm curious. You've seen it twice. What do you think?
Well, I know this is non-spoilery, but if you see me, you know, bending down to sip something, it's because I need a bottle of this to get through this talk. So I'm going to be sipping that throughout the day.
Cheers.
I'll say this. When Taika Waititi first came on the scene with came on the MCU scene with Ragnarok, I know a lot of people were a little shook by it. This was a different approach to Thor. Me personally, I thought it was a bit too comedic at first. It did grow on me over time though, and I did appreciate it. I'm not against comedy. Lots of comedic things throughout the MCU, but that was definitely a lot all at once. But I am a big fan of his. I like a lot of his other projects, and I know he's able to mesh drama and comedy together, especially with Jojo Rabbit. That is an amazing film. If anybody hasn't seen it, I strongly recommend it. It's a great film. It'll make you laugh. It'll make you cry. It'll make you, you know, reflect. It's a great film. So I was willing to give this a shot, especially even after a lot of the pre-comments out there, pre-critics out there, who basically sounded like they were saying the same thing for Thor Ragnarok, and I had come to appreciate Thor Ragnarok. So I went into this with a very open mind. The only thing I can think of right now, and the thing that I thought of the most when I walked out of the theater, was an older article that I read that talked about Kevin Feige now being too busy to be super involved with every film in the MCU, and how he was kind of taking a step back to a little distance point, whereas he used to be the overlord looking over and ensuring the quality of every film. Because I do feel like someone just let Taika Waititi do what he wanted to do, and there wasn't a lot of checks and balances. This film, it feels fitting that it's sharing theaters with Minions, because to me it's on the same level of silliness. It's not a comedy to me. It's silliness. And I thought it was just too much.
And people dress up for both this and Minions opening night. So
that's true. That's true.
Suits for the one, cosplays for the other. Mm-hmm. I completely understand where you're coming from with that. And I agree that Taika Waititi maybe should have been reined in a little bit on this one. But overall, I had a good time with this. I thought I did a rewatch of the previous, like the first two Thor movies. Like I did a Jane Foster rewatch. I did not do a Thor rewatch and do like Infinity War and Endgame and all. Like that was just too much. I was like, I'll watch Thor 1 and 2 and pick up that story in this one.
Hmm.
I thought the performances were great all around. I thought Christian Bale was a great villain. But I do agree that it does feel a little too Taika at moments. Especially, and we'll get into spoilers, especially that first act. It just feel like with the reports of there being a 4-hour cut of this film out there, like it just felt like they cut a whole bunch of stuff and like, okay, we're just going to fix it with Korg narration. And that didn't really work for me. But overall, I enjoyed the film. I was kind of all in to begin with, though, because I don't know if you've noticed behind me, I've got
the poster.
I've got the Jane Foster poster, courtesy of Disney Movie Insiders. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I was excited for this from the get-go. It's definitely not the worst Marvel movie I've seen. It's definitely not my least favorite Marvel movie I've seen in theaters over the last year.
Okay. I think it fits perfectly in Phase 4 because Phase 4 continues to be aimless and seemingly a mess. I mean,
yeah.
This film, again, but the most makes me realize how long ago Endgame was. I mean, the whole Infinity Stones saga feels like an eternity ago, pun intended. Those films, while there were missteps in those, that saga overall felt so tight and looking back over it, you know, just seeing how it all came together, Phase 4 continues to feel like it's just going on aimlessly. But then this film in particular, it also felt like it was going on aimlessly. I have heard about that 4 cut, and we'll get into some of the other things we've heard about since then, because I don't want to post spoilers. But there's, you know, if this was Taika reined in, It wasn't enough. There is a thin thread of plot to this film. While Christian Bale is great, everything he does well, in my opinion, is undercut by the people he's sharing a scene with. Whatever performance he's bringing, whatever tones he's adding to the story, sometimes in the exact same scene are clashed with the people that he's talking to. And this a constant war of, is this a comedy? Is this a drama? Is this just, you know, ridiculousness on screen? I wanted to like it. I loved seeing Natalie Portman back in the role. There was a lot of things that I thought, oh, this could be really interesting. But, you know, especially after the second rewatch, it just made me miss the Thor from Infinity War. I thought that was one of the best, you know, times we've seen Thor on screen, with his range, with his the obstacles, how he overcame things, how he rose to the challenge. You know, if Ragnarok was kind of a dumber down idiot like Thor, this took that to an even more level. I thought it was just extreme, and the more I thought about it, the more I realized this would never fly with any other character in the MCU. If another director came in and did an Iron Man movie or Captain America movie or any other main character movie and messed with the core of the character this much and just dumbed it and sillied it down this much, it just wouldn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people are going to start getting tired of it with Thor eventually, if not with this film.
Yeah. No, it's a fair point. I think I wonder if maybe Taika learned the wrong lesson with Ragnarok, which was Ragnarok leans a lot more on Chris Hemsworth's comedic side that you see in Ghostbusters and other projects before Ragnarok. They lean more into that, and I think it works for the character in that. I feel like in this one, it does go overboard to a point, but I still think I can see what they were trying to do with the character to keep his story going along from Endgame and Infinity War. But it felt a little bit forced in moments. Like, I'm trying to figure out how to talk about this without getting the spoilers, which is tricky. I think it, do you think this film works as a rom-com? Because that's what they keep calling it. This film is the Marvel Cinematic Universe's first romantic comedy.
No. I think it wanted to. I think it puts in elements to try to be, and it even goes as far as to kind of try to, not really retcon, but fill in the blanks of the previous films, because I think a lot of people thought that the Jane-Thor romance of the previous films was kind of always the weaker aspects of those films, like just not enough meat on the bone.
Mm-hmm.
And there's parts of this film that tries to go back and re-inject that meat onto the bone in order to make this film work. I didn't think so. I think I wanted it to. I wanted it to, having seen the other films, to see this character come back. I wanted it to work, but I don't think it had enough time to work. And again, every time I felt that there could be some levity to the scene was either cut short or it was bombarded with silliness, and I couldn't, you know? So
yeah.
I think it wanted to be a rom-com. I think they're certainly trying to sell it as a rom-com, but I think even I, you know, even the, with their attempts, I don't think they landed it. I think they missed the landing.
Okay. Anything else we can talk about before we get into spoilers?
I mean, if you're looking for a one-off, this definitely feels like a one-off. It feels like it's not really connected to the rest of the MCU. In fact, when you start asking questions, it feels like it's flying in the face of the rest of the MCU. There's a lot of things in this film that you're like, well, if that's something that could happen, why not? And then a laundry list of previous events that this could have worked for.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a fan of Chris Hemsworth, man, he looks great. You know, he's up there sporting his best self. If you're a fan of creators injecting their kids into their work and giving them a platform, this is that film, for better or for worse. If you're a fan of Taika Waititi and his voice, this is the film for you. I think you said it's not the worst. I agree it's not the worst, but I do feel it's in the bottom tier. And okay. It did make me rethink my thoughts on Thor: The Dark World. And gosh, a lot has to not work for me to rethink my thoughts on The Dark World.
So out of the four Thor films, where do you rank this?
I was trying to do this the other day, but I already know I'm controversial because I liked Thor 1
mm-hmm.
better than most people.
I
really liked it. I really liked Thor 1. I think that, to me, is still his best movie, even though the character has changed so much since then. So I would put that first. I would put Ragnarok second. I would put this third, and this tied with third for The Dark World, because, you know, if you told me, hey, we're going to go see a Thor movie tomorrow, which one do you want to see, Dark World or this? I would see Dark World. And I can't see myself rewatching this film after the two times it did it. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
I would probably.
What about you?
I would probably rank it similarly. Like, I have this pretty much tied with Ragnarok. So I'd have, I still really like the first Thor movie, especially going back and rewatching it. Kenneth Branagh brings such a Shakespearean accent to it, and it just feels very theater-like and Shakespearean with the way that they're dressed and the way they act, like their accents. Like, that film still really works for me. But I feel like this is pretty much tied for Ragnarok with me, and then The Dark World's last. But there's still some redeeming qualities of The Dark World, going back and rewatching it. Because I haven't rewatched that since Endgame. So, yeah, I say this is, if you're torn on this, if you don't know if you want to go see this in theaters, just maybe you could probably wait the, what is it now, 5 weeks for it to be on Disney Plus.
Yeah.
And you're probably not going to miss anything. I did see this in ScreenX. So if you can see this in ScreenX, there was one sequence in particular that was phenomenal that had me like in awe of the cinematography and laughing my ass off, which we'll get into here in a moment. But overall, Josh, what do you rank Thor Love and Thunder?
I think I told you this over the weekend. After first watch, coming home tired, not really trying to think about it, I gave it a 2.5 out of 5. After the second watch and having some time for it to be in my mind and for me to chew on it, I go down to like a 1.75. I know that's in the metrics now, but 1.75, 2 out of 5, not very high for me. What about you?
If we're going to go metrics, I'm gonna throw a 3.75 in here. Not quite a 4, but almost. So if we're rounding up a 4.
Okay.
I think there's a lot here to enjoy. There is some stuff that is a little bit eye-rolly, but if you go with it and go with the flow, there's an enjoyable story here. So, yeah, I think on that note, we will be now getting into spoilers. So if you've not seen Thor Love and Thunder, this is your spoiler warning. So yeah, let's get into it. So where do you want to start with spoilers?
Well, first of all, I just want to verify for you and for the audience, you are being genuine, right? You're not just knowing my side and then you being the opposite side for the sake of a podcast, right?
I can see that there are issues with this, but I still had a good time seeing it. I can see that.
I figured you were. I just wanted to state that, you know, so people aren't thinking that we have to be on one side or the other.
I'm not being paid by Disney like Kevin Smith. Like, not that he's actually paid by Disney. No, Marvel is still in the area where I give them a lot of leniency, because this film was done in the height of the pandemic. So there's a lot of things that were probably not as well managed as they would have been back in 2016 for Ragnarok when they were filming that. So I give them a little bit of slack for that, because all the production meetings were probably over Zoom. Kevin Feige couldn't go to New Zealand. Like, they filmed in New Zealand, so that's one thing. Like, you could only get so many people at a time into New Zealand. Like, every time somebody was added to this cast, you found out because they were able to go to New Zealand, which was on complete lockdown. So there were a lot of spoilers about cameos in this just from that. So I, like, with all of that in mind, I still had a good time with this movie. But I do, like, I completely understand where you're coming from. Like, like the one of the biggest issues I had with this movie was Korg, and I love Korg. When they just made him a face, I was like, really? Like, okay, I guess. But yeah, no, I generally enjoyed this movie.
And I'm happy for you. I don't like being a negative Nelly on this, or Nancy, or whatever you want to call me. I just thought the writing for this film was weak. From the get-go. I mean, from the very first scene before the Marvel logo came up, I had a hint of hope, because this film cold opens on Christian Bale's Gore with his daughter walking across a barren desert and seemingly lost everything. It's a great performance. You see this the man praying to his God, begging for to be saved. If not him, then at least his daughter, holding his daughter as she dies, and then just waiting to die himself. I was like, this is great. In fact, a lot of people were thrown by this. People were still talking when the scene first started, because there is no like text or Marvel's logo or anything to start the film. So once people realized, oh shit, this is the film, the theater went quiet and everybody was zoned in on this. After the child dies, Gore is summoned, is called, stumbles upon this oasis, this makeshift oasis, and in there meets his God, presumably. Mm-hmm. And from the point of this scene, I saw an actor who can portray any character to any degree, who can bring levity to a scene, who can really fill in the drama that's needed to any role, met with the comedy style of Mr. Bean. And it was so jarring. Like, you know, I'm a big Zack Snyder defender. I know a lot of people aren't, and I'm not trying to make this a Snyder cut or anything like that. But I thought of movies like Immortals and other films where we see men coming up in contact with Greek gods and or superior beings, and just seeing the weight of those scenes and everything. This was just, on one side of the screen was a dramatic performance, on the other side of the screen was just silliness that I was like, is this going to be the whole movie? And unfortunately, it was. I just, from that point, I realized that there was going to be tonal clashes throughout the whole film.
I think part of what those tonal clashes, for me, what those tonal clashes represented was the arrogance of the gods. Like, especially with Gore's God at the beginning and then later on with Zeus. Like, there's a very, very real arrogance of, oh, we're gods, you can't touch us. And I think the tonal difference between Gore and the gods that he interacts with, including Thor, I think exudes that. And that's how I read it. I see where you're coming from, but for me, that's how I read it.
And I get that. I just feel like you could have portrayed arrogance in another way than drowning in silliness.
Yeah.
And then just overall, I couldn't help but think back to Thor 1 and Odin's line of, we are not gods. We were born, we live, we die, just as humans do. That doesn't seem like it's from the same universe as this film. In this film, there are gods. You know, even what was it, Guardians of the Galaxy 2, when Star-Lord's dad says, little g, I'm a god with a little g. You know, I don't know if those were just attempts by Disney not to piss off their religious viewers back in the day, and now they've thrown that to the wind, or if Taika Waititi just doesn't know enough about the MCU's past to care about things like that.
Yeah.
But this film was, no, these are all gods. These are all gods. There's big gods and there's little gods, and they vary in power. but they are gods, and there's many of them, and it kept on, like, we are gods. Like, I wonder what the word count for God in this film was, because they say it quite often.
Yeah.
And it was a lot.
So I think my understanding of it is the gods are all alien beings. So they're not actually gods. They're just alien beings with abilities.
Mm-hmm.
All around. But yeah, it does kind of, continuity wise, it does kind of mess with what Odin says in the first one.
If you or someone you know is listening to this podcast right now and you're struggling with suicide, addiction, self-harm, or depression, we encourage you guys to please reach out. This is the heartbeat of why we do what we do. Suicide is currently the 10th leading cause of death in the United States, and as of this recording, there are 132 suicides that take place each and every day on American soil. And when you scale back internationally, there are 800,000 successful suicides. That is one death roughly every 40 seconds. So if you or someone you know is struggling, you guys can go to victimsandvillains.net/hope. That resource is going to be right in the description wherever you guys are currently listening or streaming this. There you'll find resources that include the National Suicide Lifeline, which is 1-800-273-8255. You can also text HELP to 741-741. We also have a plethora of other resources, including churches, getting connected with counselors, LGBT resources like the Trevor Project, and also Veteran Hotline as well. Please, if you hear nothing else in the show, understand that you, yes, you listening to this right now, have value and worth. We get it. Suicide, depression, mental health, these are hard topics, and the stigma around them doesn't make it any easier. But please consider the resources right in the descriptions below, wherever you guys are listening, because once again, you have value and you have worth. So please stay with us.
I mean, Odin presented himself as a powerful being,
mm-hmm,
with responsibilities. There wasn't one god in this film that seemed to do the same. Like, every other god in this film was, let's get drunk, let's get fat, let's have an orgy. And I get the, you know, this it's a Greek thing and everything like that, and they're playing into it. But I was waiting for at least one god to take things seriously. And then I also felt like, you know, we didn't get enough of Gore the God Butcher. We saw him butcher one god, and then we heard of his exploits, but we didn't see enough of his exploits for me to really find him as a formidable villain. I mean, Taika Waititi spent the last year saying, this is the best villain in the MCU universe. This is, you know, there's nothing that compares to him. And while I believe he's Christian Bale is one of the best actors to grace the MCU universe, I did not feel like they did enough for me to find this guy as formidable. He certainly had some cool tricks up his sleeve.
Yeah.
But I was like, I really kind of wanted more of his destruction in order for me to fear him, because I didn't really. And then once he went up against Thor, he didn't win in any of his fights. It just kept on getting delayed to the next fight. So I really didn't see him as like a formidable force to be reckoned with.
I think the more potent villain here is the Necrosword that's corrupting him. Because once that's gone, his motivations completely change. And it makes me wonder if Gore's intentions the whole time were to make the wish at eternity to kill all the gods, or if he was just going to wish for his daughter back.
Well, he was still going to wish for gods to die even after he didn't have the sword anymore. For a while there, he had to be convinced at the end.
I don't know if he did, because even before Thor goes off on his tangent that ends up like his heart to heart with Gore at the end, even before he does that, Gore says to him, I'm dying. She'll still be alone. Like, soon. Mm. Like he knows he's dying. So I think his intentions were always to bring back his daughter. Like, and I think part of that is because he lost the sword there at the end and was not as corrupted by it. But I think there was always a part of him that, like, I think especially at the end there, that's what he wanted. I think that's part of the reason he stopped butchering the gods and kidnapped those kids. Is he doesn't want to kill. He just wants what he desires. And he kidnaps those kids as a way to get that.
Well, if that was the intention, I think they could have spent some more time with him on screen showing the internal struggle or something against the sword, because honestly, he just didn't have enough screen time for me to really appreciate him. And you know, again, I feel like there was a lot of lazy writing elements in this film. You know, like when he, in that first scene, when he stumbles on his god, the god opens up by saying, "Oh, we just killed this guy. And why did we kill him? Because he had the sword right there on the ground. Mm-hmm. That is that could kill me." And then he grabs it and kills him. You know, how do we get to eternity? Oh, it's just in the center of the universe. Everybody apparently knows where it's at. You know, what is his plan? Oh, Jane sees his plan written on the walls and realizes that Stormbreaker is the key to eternity. Stormbreaker, conveniently Thor's main weapon. There was a lot of like, just, oh, they stumble upon, or the answer is told to them without really having to look for it.
Yeah.
And then just the idea of eternity being this, as Jane says, a wishing well, being this being that as long as you have Stormbreaker, Thor's weapon, and you know where eternity is, which apparently Thor does, and you can get in, you can make any wish. I can think of several things in recent films that Thor would have wanted to go wish for, but he didn't.
Am I missing
something in that?
I don't think the key to it, like the key to it in this film, is Stormbreaker, because Stormbreaker summons the Bifrost.
Mm-hmm.
Before Stormbreaker, you just needed the Bifrost to get in there. So right now, as far as we know in the MCU, the only way to get the Bifrost is Stormbreaker. That's why Stormbreaker is the MacGuffin of the whole thing.
Sure. But he's had Stormbreaker since Infinity War.
Yeah.
He spent 5 years sulking about losing. In the 5 years, he didn't think to go to Eternity and wish that Thanos never got the stones?
I think there's a cost to it. Like, I don't think anyone can just go. Like, I feel like if Gore hadn't died of his wounds, he would have had to pay a price to Eternity for his wish. And I think that's... Well,
are you filling in the blanks, or did I miss that whole conversation in the movie? Because I don't remember that conversation.
I feel like there was something about it. Just the way it's set up. Like, I don't think it's meant to be that simple. Like, it just...
It might not meant to be that simple, but
it the way it's presented, it might be. Yeah.
And I'm just rambling on about things I didn't like. What are some of the things that you really liked?
Things that I really liked? Okay. Let's see. What did I really like?
There was a scene that you said that in 4DX was just blew your mind.
So the scene that blew my mind in 4DX was, there's a point in the film when they make it to the Shadow Realm.
The Shadow Realm or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They make it to the Shadow Realm and everything goes black and white. I was like, this is amazing, because the screens on the sides all go dark too. Like, they go from the light of the ship with the Bifrost to dark. And then you just see their ship crash into the planet, and you hear those damn goats yell. I got a poster here for the goats. You hear those goats yell, and I lost it. But then the whole scene with the use of black and white and the way they changed the way they were doing sound in that scene, made it feel really old school Hollywood, and like it was something out of the 1940s. And then you had elements of like Jane using Mjolnir to light up the room when she's finding out about the Stormbreaker being key. Like, she lights up the room and the sound changes. There's a hint of color from Mjolnir. I just really liked how that was all done. Like, that whole sequence was phenomenal to me.
Yeah, I did like the color balance in that. It did look really well. I did like how there was just bits of color kind of seeping through because of the hammer. Yeah, that was neat. And every time you talk about this theater of yours, I get jealous and need to find a nearby option, because it sounds really cool.
What was funny was there was a family in front of us. I don't think they realized what they bought tickets for, because the very first scene of the movie, what you talked about before with Gore and his daughter, whole screen lights up right from the get-go, right off the trailers. And the whole row of the family was just like, what's going on? Like, I don't understand why the walls are lighting up right now. What is happening? So they did not know that they spent $20 a ticket for that experience. So that was enjoyable.
The girl next to me, there was a young couple next to me, and she laughed hard every time those goats screamed. I mean, that was a joke that some people think was redundant. Not her. She laughed every time, and I'm like, hey man, I guess if it does the thing for you, good on you. And but that was, you know, that was one of several jokes that Taika did again and again and again and again in this film, and you know, every time I hear things about this 4-hour cut, I'm like, and he says he trimmed jokes. I sometimes wonder, well, were any of them better than repeating the same joke 6 times in the film? Or apparently he filmed things with Lena Headey and Peter Dinklage and Jeff Goldblum that didn't make the cut. Lena Headey got paid $7 million for scenes that weren't even in the theatrical cut. And at some point, I would, you know, like, people were saying, like, all the extra footage they shot for Top Gun was what am I trying to say? Excessive. Well, that's you trying to catch jets in the air just right. You know, apparently he filmed over 4 hours, because if there's a 4-hour cut, that's not everything. So he filmed way over 4 hours worth of content, and with big actors, and then just kind of piecemealed it together. And I wonder if there was a better story in that longer cut, or if it was just more stuff to throw in, because it, you know, I doubt it. I doubt there was a stronger story in that, and not just more content, because every other scene in this was just an extension of a previous joke or a callback to a Ragnarok joke.
Yeah.
And I kept on being like, all right, let's get back to the plot. Let's get back to the plot of this thing.
One thing I wish that there was more of in the film is, we get a lot of Jane Foster, but we don't get much of her story. A lot of her story is reliant on her relationship with Thor, which is okay, because you're bringing her back for the Thor movie. But I really wanted to see more of her wielding Mjolnir for the first time, and that building that relationship with Valkyrie, because stuff has happened with them before Thor shows up, but we don't get to see any of that. I would have loved to see more of that. I think what they have of her in this film is great. I think she brings the same energy to Jane Foster that she did in even The Dark World. She's so charismatic and energetic when she's in Asgard, like talking about like just being so enthusiastic about the world around her and learning new things, that she brings that same energy to this. It would have just been great to see more of it, and not just, oh, hey, this is awkward because we used to date, and oh, yeah, I have cancer. I would have liked to see more of that energy.
Yeah, agreed. I would have liked to see her learning her power set and becoming confident in her power set instead of just I'm working on a catchphrase. And the you know, I am not Lady Thor scene, I feel, was trying to mirror the what are you the god of again scene from Ragnarok, mm-hmm. except we had a foundation with Thor and his power set that was like, oh yeah, bring on the power, bring on the confidence that scene turned into, whereas her, you know, I'm not Lady Thor, I'm Mighty Thor, a scene, yeah, it didn't have the foundation of her really owning that role and becoming that role and figuring that out for herself. And yeah, I agree. I feel like if we would have got some of that stuff, we could have appreciated her thing. I feel like she was, you know, she's in a majority of the film, but it does feel like she's in and out. Even her death scene, I feel like was missing weight and was missing, you know, some gravitas for the film. I felt like it was just over and done with. And I was like, that's it? That's how she goes? And I know there's a after credit scene, and that almost discounted her death even more, you know? So it was, you know, I think I was most excited to see her coming back into this film. And just like Gore, I wanted more of her and less of, you know, the joke of the minute.
Yeah. For me, it was weird seeing her fight Christian Bale because I kept getting the shots of them at the Oscars together when they both won in the same year. Mm. So I kept seeing that image like, oh yeah, they're kind of friendly outside of this too. So, real quick, the post-credit scene that you mentioned with her in Valhalla actually changed the point of view of the film for my wife completely.
Really?
She was upset that they brought her back just to kill her. And then that scene, gave it like a little bit more closure and like set something. I feel like that's gotta be setting something up for the future. Like it's yeah. weird that they just show Valhalla.
I was going to say closure.
Yeah.
You really thought that was the end?
Instead, well, she was more of, like it wasn't just, they didn't just bring her back to kill her. Like there, it seems like there's a plan for them going into the future. And I think that's progress a little bit for Marvel, because I feel like a lot of the times they kill their darlings and then just let them be dead at the bottom of Vilmir. And then they get the spinoff and it doesn't really matter.
Come now. That was a once in a blue moon type situation. I feel like the MCU has always struggled with people staying dead, with the exception of their best villains. And the MCU has always struggled with, okay, but are they really dead? And to the point where it didn't even let the film end, where they're like, not really. You know, expect, you know, Thor Valhalla as part five, and we're bringing her back. You know, that's what I talked about taking away from her death, because it was already done, you know?
Even if even if they don't address her in the future and bring her back, if you end it with the Jane Foster from Thor 1 and Love and Thunder, you end it with her being greeted by Idris Elba.
Heimdall.
You end it with her.
Skinny Heimdall, by the way.
Yeah.
He looked small for some reason.
You end it with her walking into Valhalla and just taking it all in. Like that's the Jane Foster that we got to know in those first two films. Like the wanting to learn more about the world around, the universe around her. And I think even just knowing that that's where she's at now, I think that's a more satisfying ending than her dying in Thor's arms. Like I like that ending for her so much more. And if they don't bring her back, okay. But if they do, okay. Like I'm sure they'll do something with it in the future.
Yeah, but it certainly felt like that. What did you feel about that? About Thor being able to tell the hammer to take care of Jane, and then later being able to share the power of Thor with all of the kids, despite not having the hammer, and just being able to temporarily share his power with, you know, 20 or so kids. Do you think that is just convenient for this movie's sake? Does it make you think, like, why didn't he do that in Wakanda or in other circumstances? And why now?
I think in Wakanda, I think what it is showing that he is his father's son. Like, he has the power to do the enchantments. I think the Mjolnir scene where he tells the hammer to watch over her is just him not knowing that he's doing it. Like, he doesn't know he has that ability, like, protect her at all, like, no matter what. Like, he doesn't know that he's actually doing an enchantment. And I think he at some point becomes aware that he has that ability, and that's why he can do it with Stormbreaker. Did he have Stormbreaker at that point?
No, he had the bolt.
Oh.
He had Thunderbolt, which made even less sense to me.
Yeah.
Because he said power of Thor, not power of Zeus or whatever.
Yeah. I don't know if it's the objects that give him the power. I think that's just something that he has inside of him. Like, he has the power of thunder inside of him and doesn't need a hammer. You know, like they talked about in Ragnarok and then completely threw away in the next movie, where he had to go make a hammer. My biggest problem with the hammers in all of this is Stormbreaker having a personality. Like, that was the one thing I was like, okay, we haven't seen any signs of this before. Even in Mjolnir, like, it didn't really have, like, a personality. It was just kind of, you could either pick it up or you couldn't. This time, it's, like, giving you death glares and sneaking into the frame. I'm like, that's a little bit much. That was a bit much for me.
And then multiple times to the point where he's scratching it like it has a chin and pouring a beer over it and it's showing jealousy and stuff like that. Like, the one time could have been like, ah, that's a little over the top, but it's kind of funny. And then it happens again and it happens again, and that's what I'm saying. Like, there's a lot of jokes that repeat throughout this film. And I'm like, all right, I get it. And then there's jokes that repeat from previous films, like the acting out scene with Chris Hemsworth's brother and Matt Damon. They not only brought that joke back, and Sam Neill, they not only brought that joke back, but it was the extended cut. It went on considerably longer than the scene in Ragnarok. And then they brought Melissa McCarthy out to do it as well. So that scene kept on going, and to the point where I was like, Where are they going to do the whole Ragnarok film? And then they ended it, and I'm like, oh, okay, all right.
So,
because it goes on for a minute.
I have a theory about that. I knew about that whole scene months in advance because set photos leaked from people boats watching them film this on the cliffs of New Zealand. And there, I think the Guardians of the Galaxy were there when they were filming that. So I think that's part of the mystery of the weirdly cut up first act of this film. Like, I feel like there was more to that scene, because it doesn't make any sense that we're seeing any of that, because Jane's not there. They're just kind of showing it to us. But I feel like if you had the Guardians there or Thor, like, that would be make a little bit more sense for that all to be there. But it's just kind of there because, hey, look, we're doing this joke again.
I did like it when it first came on. I was like, oh, the crew's back, because I did like that joke in Ragnarok. I liked seeing Matt Damon in this ridiculousness, and Sam, I love Sam Neill, despite my lackluster thoughts on the latest Jurassic Park, and I like seeing Chris Hemsworth's brother in there. I feel bad calling Luke. Him Chris Hemsworth's brother. That's Luke Hemsworth from Westworld.
Westworld, yeah.
And I was like, okay, they're bringing this back. That's fun. And expanded on the, it's no longer the bleak, undercover-esque fishing village from Infinity War. It's turned into this whole thing. They've really leaned into it.
Yeah. It's a tourist destination.
I did like those things. Yeah. I mean, sure. Why not? You know,
I mean,
I feel like Valkyrie wouldn't give a shit.
Yeah.
You know,
I just did it. I feel like it's bad taste to have an ice cream place called the Infinity Scone, like cones. I straight up forgot that the Guardians of the Galaxy were in this movie, and I've seen the movie and I still forget.
Well, I think that was the one thing that somebody told Tycho that he had to address, because everything else is just, let's hurry up and get on to whatever Tycho wants to do with this film. You know? That was the only thing that really connected for me to previous stuff.
I feel like they had to address it because Thor does go off. But I feel like that whole montage with Korg, like doing the narration, I feel like each bit of that we saw was an actual scene. Like there's a moment where Thor is talking to Star-Lord on the ship. There's other battles.
There's scenes from the trailer that aren't in the film of him and the Guardians.
Yeah. So, part of me wishes there was more of that, but.
Remember when everybody thought that's what Thor 4 was going to be about? Like, it was going to be a Thor and Guardians of the Galaxy movie? People legit thought that either the next Guardians of the Galaxy was going to be a team-up movie, or the next Thor was. Not, you know, hurry up and
part of me wonders. Part of me wonders if back when Guardians 3 was supposed to be the big film in 2020, if that was going to be the plan. Like, if Thor was going to be part of Guardians for Guardians 3, and then when they fired James Gunn and delayed the film, like that got canceled, and we got this instead. Then that's not a COVID thing. That was just a Disney being Disney thing and rearranging their schedule at the last second. So I would have liked to see more of Thor with the Guardians. I hope we will, maybe in the holiday special that we're getting in December. But
speaking of the scenes with him and the Guardians, I did see somebody talk about this, and I was like, man, you're reading my soul when you talk about this. Where they said it felt like in those scenes that Thor had regressed to his character at the beginning of Thor 1. This arrogant guy who didn't really care about the consequences of his actions. I mean, here he was sitting up on a hilltop while people were dying beneath him, waiting for somebody to be like, please come save us. Then when they did, he went down there, ignored anything that was told to him, like, this is our most sacred building thing, shrine on this planet, and they've taken over. And then he just goes and there was no shock to me that that got destroyed. I was like, that's going to be destroyed. What was shocking to me is that he, like, had no reaction to it. Like, it was just like, you asked for Thor, that's what you get. And I'm like, that's not the Thor that we've become accustomed to. Even at the end of Thor 1, you know, when he's like, all right, it's time for me to go home. He walks away from town so that the Bifrost doesn't disturb anything. In this film, he's wrecking buildings, he's destroying shrines, he's like a child again. For comedic purposes, I get it, but in terms of his character, I was like, what happened to all the depth? What is this thoughtful Thor that we've become accustomed to? And it seems like it's only in films that Taika's not directed.
The only thing that I can say that the Thor from the first film wouldn't have done that this Thor does is when he's about to leave, he does say to the high priest or whoever it was, I want to talk to you about the temple. Oh, I don't want to talk about the temple. Like, he goes to apologize about it, which I don't think Thor in the first film would have done. I think he's still lost and confused about who he is. Like, he says that in the film. Like, I'm trying to figure out who I am. Like, I feel like he got lost in the moment and got cocky, and he's like, oh, I shouldn't have done that. Like, that's my bad. Like, he realizes he did wrong, which I don't think you would have seen in that first Kenneth Branagh film.
Perhaps not. Yeah. I was just still thrown by, you know, riding Stormbreaker like a like the Wicked Witch of the West, and just everything. Yeah. He just seems so dumb, you know. He seems so like, you know, beside himself. Like there was no consequence. It's one thing, like the, you know, when I saw these scenes in the trailer, and there's a scene where everybody's fighting and he just walks off. I've seen the trailer several times. Yeah. He just has this look of, I'm just not here for this, and walks off. When I saw that scene in the trailer, I'm like, all right, we're gonna see this Thor that's tired of fighting. You know, like he you know, Infinity War. He got through it. He went through this big crisis in his life, and now he's just tired of fighting. That's not what the Thor was in this film. He was the, I'm just going to wait till they call me, and then I'm going to go and do some Jean-Claude Van Damme shit, and then we'll be done, and we'll just, you know, laugh it off till the next mission. Like, it was all comedy, and I was like, man, there was so much weight in that couple-second scene in the trailer that was missing from the whole Guardians montage in the actual film.
And if you know how trailers work, the trailer companies that make those are given like certain things from the film that the studio think would look good in a trailer, and they take the best of those and put together a trailer. So that sticks. That helps my theory of the whole first act of this was completely rewritten into montages. Everything in this movie is just a montage.
It is. It does feel like montage.
And we didn't even get the training montage of Thor getting fit that I wanted. It was just like he went from sad bod to bad bod, like. But I think the biggest culprit of this is just King Valkyrie's storyline. Like, when you see Valkyrie as King of Asgard, it's just a montage, and you don't get any depth to anything going on there. And it helps get the movie along to where it's going. But I wanted to see her and Meek in meetings and dealing with the bureaucracy of being the head of this now tourist destination, and what is it? Where is she at? Like, instead, we're just like, oh, hey, Thor, welcome back. Like, that's like the first thing she says. It's like, why?
Yeah, that continues my thing, that depth is what's missing from this whole film, but especially her. She seems, her character throughout this whole film, how she dresses to how she acts, is just an extension from her drunkenness in Thor Ragnarok. You would think that after the choices she made to return and defend Asgard, she would have evolved since then, and then taking on the king, you know, ship of New Asgard. Yeah, I was anxious to see her development. There was no development. Yeah. Her entire character was, meh, I don't care about this, I'm just along for the ride. And like every other primary character of this film, I thought the depth was missing. And I thought the depth was missing from Thor the most, because, yeah, every time, going back to that scene where he gives the power of Thor to those kids, I wanted to be like, where did you learn this? Where did you, at least in Thor Ragnarok, it was about him regaining his confidence and you know, like upgrading, you know, and it felt earned. There was nothing about this that felt that he'd found himself, you know. Like, I don't feel like his character ever went through something and came out the other side in this film. He was just there. He has this power to now give his power to all these people. It wasn't like there was a moment where he was at his lowest and Odin was like, you know, talking to him or something.
To be fair, he doesn't give the power to the kids. He gives the power to their weapons to give them the power of Thor. So he's enchanting their stuffed animals and their sticks.
How would you guys like to help us get mental health resources into schools, conventions, and other events? Well, now you can. Simply go to patreon.com/victimsandvillains for as little as $1 a month. You guys can help us get mental health resources into current and upcoming generations, educate and break down stigma surrounding mental health, suicide, and depression. And you get exclusive content that you can't get anywhere else. And you guys can tell us which Nicolas Cage movie you want us to cover, and we'll do it. All it takes to get started is to go to patreon.com/victimsandvillains or simply click the link in the episode description wherever you guys are currently listening or streaming this episode. Pick your tier and get started today. Yes, it's that simple. So quickly select the tier that you want and help us get hope into the hands of the depressed and the suicidal today.
Okay. But their eyes light up. So,
but they could, because they have the power of Thor, just like Captain America's eyes lit up when he wielded Mjolnir. Whoever wields the hammer, shall they be worthy, shall possess the powers of Thor.
So, I'm sure everybody at the Battle of Endgame or the Battle of Wakanda and Infinity War would have loved that. And if we had even one line that said, "I didn't know I could do this before," or something that suggested he learned it, then I wouldn't be saying these things. But when I see things like that, and then I completely something separate from this movie, but I read things about Taika Waititi offered Natalie Portman a role in his Star Wars film, not knowing that she was a lead in 3 Star Wars films, it makes me feel like, and I'm not one like, oh, you got to know everything about the history of Thor to direct Thor. But it feels like it's, I'm Taika Waititi. I don't need to know anything before Taika Waititi. I just want to do my film.
So the Natalie Portman thing, I can see, like, in the moment, like on a film set, like just blanking and forgetting that she was in the prequels, because they're, to her credit, she has done a great job of having a career outside of the Star Wars prequels. Oh, yeah. Just like Ewan McGregor, not so much like Hayden Christensen, but so I can easily see that, like, it's in the moment, and it becomes a funny story that you tell in interviews.
I know it's more of a joke than a headline, but I mean, it makes me think of things like that when things like this, things happen in this movie, it doesn't make sense with previous entries. Yeah. In terms of power sets, and there's no even a chance at explanation for it.
I can't say if there's an explanation for it in the comics. The best I can give you is that it's just something that he can do now that he's not the king, but is he the All Father now because Odin's dead? Like, I think it's just genetic.
Is he? I don't know.
And I wonder if maybe Zeus's lightning bolt is like a powerful enough tool to give him the ability to do that. So
perhaps let's talk about omnipotent cities. That's one thing we haven't even addressed yet at all. I liked it. Again, it feels like there was a lot of fetch quest vibes in this film that really didn't lead anywhere. Like, originally they went there to get an army and they came out with a weapon that didn't really seem to help him at the end. But what did you think of the presentation of Omnipotent City and all the gods there and the stuff
that we saw? I was impressed by it. Again, with the Screen X, the whole screen lit up for the whole arena scenes. So you're surrounded by all of the gods when he's on stage. And they didn't really just focus on his body too much when Thor gets naked, which is not a sentence I ever thought I'd say. I enjoyed it. I thought I was not expecting the Greek accent coming from Russell Crowe. But I enjoyed it. It was as much as I didn't like his character, I thought he gave a great performance. If we're talking about continuity things, I think this is just something Marvel's gonna have to deal with all over the place now, because if you go by Eternals, they were the Greek gods, and the Greek gods never really existed, but here the Greek gods do exist, so kind of contradicts.
Is that what they said? Did Did they say the Eternals were the Greek gods? Did I miss that?
They made up that story, yeah. So I don't know if somebody, yeah. So
in the film or in the comics?
In the film, they mention it.
Well, that shows how much I remember. But they did have one of the people that
Celestials.
Runs Celestials looking into the window. I did
two
get,
of them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I think it's just a semantics thing. I think they both existed, but the stories were exaggerated by the Eternals. That's my read on that.
Is there a cut where Jesus was shown? Because they mention him, and he's the one. He's the only mention that they don't cut and show who they're talking about. Did you catch that?
No, I did not catch that.
When they're walking through and they're like, oh, hey, there's the god of something. And then it would flash to that person. Mm-hmm. Oh, hey, there's the god of something. And it would flash. The only time they don't flash is they're like, oh, there's the god of carpentry. And, you know, it could be that's not really. But I kind of felt like, oh, they were poking the bear a little bit. And then they didn't show it. And I'm like, somebody was like, don't do it. Don't do it. Like, kind of mention it. See if someone gets it. That was the one god they didn't cut to.
Yeah.
And I was like...
But we got to see the god of dumplings. So
we got to see the god of dumplings. And we saw Korg's god on a scissors throne versus a Game of Thrones sword throne. But I did think that was hilarious that it was a scissors throne.
I did not pick up on Brock. That is hysterical.
That was clever. I did crack up at that.
That's enough to make me want to go back and watch this. I think my favorite thing, which kind of got spoiled for me from the internet and just speculation, was the mid-credit scene with this guy.
With your guy. Yeah.
Yeah. Roy Kent as Hercules coming into the MCU. Part of me is just like, just make that the live action Hercules that Guy Ritchie is going to direct for Disney. Brett Goldstein, I think, is going to make a great Hercules. I'm curious if he's going to do the accent thing that Russell Crowe did, because he doesn't say anything in this, and they definitely just shot him on green screen in the costume.
It looked like it. Yeah.
If they even did that, because there's been stuff coming out about Multiverse of Madness and how Mr. Fantastic and Black Bolt's costume were all CGI. So maybe they just had Brett Goldstein naked on a green screen and put him in the Hercules costume. So
when I saw that scene, it harkened me back to what I thought. What's his name? Adam Warlock. Adam Warlock scene. But Adam Warlock, as you told me, is apparently coming back in Guardians of the Galaxy 3. So, but it did feel like that. It felt like the reveal scene at the end of the Eternals where Harry Styles and Patton Oswalt show up. When you see things like that, do you feel confident that that will actually manifest itself into a role? Or do you feel like anymore it's like, let's toss something out, see how the audience reacts to it, and then see if a future filmmaker wants to actually touch it.
I'm trying to think if there's, besides Adam Warlock, I believe everything from the Infinity Saga, with the exception of the Far From Home post-credit scene with Nick Fury, has been addressed. I can't think of that again.
That saga feels like so long ago, and it was under. Feels like it was managed differently than Phase 4.
And it does. But at the same time, Guardians 3 originally was supposed to come out 2 years ago. If you go by the original plans for everything. So we have a delayed Adam Warlock. I know Nick Fury is coming back for Secret Invasion. And we're in the start of a new phase, so a lot of these aren't going to pay off right away. But some of the MCU post-credit scenes didn't pay off right away. I'm trying to think of ones that were a few movies down the line. Like, Thanos at the end of Age of Ultron. Like, you don't see him again until Infinity War.
True.
So there are times where it's a few movies in between until you get answers for these things. And I'm sure down the line we will get them. I don't know what they're going to be or how they're going to show up, but I have confidence that they will pay off.
Well, I hope so, because I do like the actor. What's his name again?
Brenton Goldstein.
Yeah, I like the actor. I like that he's late. I mean, you know, get the MCU. there's a lot of cameos in this film, so I guess it's not as hard as it used to be. But it could be a big thing, and I would love to see Hercules and what they do with it. But he did look kind of silly in the costume. I remember when there were complaints that the colors in the MCU were so muted that they didn't feel like they were trying to be too grounded, and they didn't feel comic booky. And then in this film, so many times it was like even Thor himself looked like he was cosplaying at Thor as Thor at times. You know, like the colors were over vibrant to a point. And yeah, seeing Brett Goldstein up there as Hercules, I'm like, I'm interested, but I hope when they actually do film, they make his costume look better, because it looked silly. It felt with the silly tone of the film.
Yeah. So you talked a bit about all the cameos in this, and I think you mentioned before that everyone's kids are in this. I didn't realize that until after the fact. I didn't realize that Gore's daughter is actually Thor's daughter. Both of his sons are in it. Christian Bale's kids are in this. Natalie Portman's kids are in this. Taika's kids are in this.
The monsters of the Shadow Realm are based on drawings of Taika Waititi's kids, and I believe Hemsworth's kids, which I believe is the excuse for their lack of detail and just kind of their overall like ridiculousness. There's a lot of kid involvement for sure.
I have a theory on why that is, and I think it has to do with the COVID lockdowns. Like, to go to New Zealand, everyone had to bring their kids if they wanted to see them. So I don't think it's a bad thing that everyone's kids are in this, because it makes it a family affair for everyone. Because everyone had to be in New Zealand for the months that they were filming this, in lockdown, in quarantines from the outside world. So I kind of like that touch of it. Like, I like the fact that everyone's kids got to come in and play.
Yeah, it felt like it was a theme of the film that could have been fleshed out more. Again, another thing that could have had more depth. Like, just the idea of Thor missing something from his life and then gaining it as at the end through becoming a dad. You know, like, I didn't feel like that was the theme of the movie, that Thor was missing this thing and Gore's daughter fills that hole. But that seems to be, like, at the end, like, now he's a dad, you know, and now he's good.
Well, Korg keeps asking about it. Like, do you think those two will have baby Thors? And it's like, he says it a lot, and I'm like, okay, dude, like, it's a bit much. So I think the film, I wonder if that's like the kids thing was a theme that came across in editing, because it feels like an afterthought, or it feels like something they added while they were filming it. Like, we have all these kids here. Part of the film is that the kids are getting kidnapped. Let's make this about him becoming a father, because down the line we can also put her into Young Avengers, because everything in Phase 4 has set up Young Avengers.
To her credit, she was great. Like, when she was talking, I liked her. But to what you're saying, every time Korg talks, I thought, oh, this is probably done in the editing room. Like, like, imagine any other film where you just had the director insert himself as a voiceover throughout the film, and you'd be like, okay, this is just lazy, like, editing. Like, you just couldn't, like, you filmed a bunch of stuff and you forgot to film enough stuff to make it all cohesively work, so you just inject your own voice into it. I mean, it's a clever trick because you made your voice a character, but it happens so often that I was like, all right, it felt more like an editing choice than a than this was, you know, originally in
there. Yeah.
And at times it was like, oh, we didn't really explain this. Well, let's have Cora come in here and explain it, you know, and add the dialogue necessary for the film to keep going.
Yeah.
I didn't mind the kids in there. Definitely did feel more like a kid film, the final battle, though, when all these kids suddenly become a part of it. But, you know, I think that could have been explored more if him becoming a dad and filling the void, you know. But again, it just felt like there was no grief of losing. You know, he had so much grief at the end of at the beginning of Endgame from the events that happened in Infinity War. And then we see him 5 years later become this mass of grief. And then we see him lose the love of his life in this film. And there's no grieving. There's no time for grief. It's the end of the movie. So we have to do these Lord of the Ring esque endings. And his ending is he's dad now, you know? Yeah. So,
the way I look at it, at the in Infinity War and Endgame, he's dealing with grief and guilt. So I think the guilt is the biggest thing that weighs on him because he doesn't want to hear Thanos' name. He doesn't want to do anything to help, like, after the fact. But he gets through that when he goes back to the Dark World and brings back Mjolnir. I think in this one he does grieve, but it doesn't have the guilt. Like, Jane made the choice. Jane sacrificed herself to save him. I think the big difference is the guilt's not there.
I also thought the lack of urgency was an issue that this film had. There was a point where they're on that planet, the Shadow Realm planet, and at the end, Gore gets the one thing he needs to access eternity. Like, they call the Bifrost, and Thor thinks he has it, but then Gore reaches out last second and pulls it away from him. You would think the second they land in New Asgard, they're like, shit, he's got the one thing he needs to access eternity. We gotta go. But then it's like, no, we gotta chill in the hospital, talk about things, get Valkyrie some. They literally stopped the fight against Gore because Valkyrie got hurt. A warrior got hurt on the battlefield, and instead of, we need to end this now, it's no, we need to get her and leave. And then the enemy gets the one thing they need to access eternity.
Yeah.
And they're like, let's just hang out at New Asgard, not, holy shit, we gotta go because he could be at Eternity's Gate now. You know,
yeah.
I felt like I was just like, don't you guys need to get going? Like, for a few minutes. It just, there was no urgency in that scene.
I'm a little upset that they kind of hinted at my headcanon for Jane Foster's cancer, but didn't full on address it. The doctor says something along the lines of, for some reason, her body is rejecting the treatment. I'm pretty sure she got the cancer as a result of the Dark World, like being injected with the ether.
Oh,
that was my headcanon going into the film. I was like, oh, they're going to address it. And then they did it. They just teased me. But they gave us
that would have added more depth. You don't think that wasn't a callback to, Episode 3, Revenge of the Sith, where for some reason she's losing the will to live. You know, like, I thought that rang the same way as that line, you know?
Yeah, I was hoping that they weren't going to go that way. Well, it couldn't be because Taika forgot that those movies existed. But I'll take not getting my headcanon confirmed for a Darcy Lewis cameo at the beginning. So.
Yeah. I'm trying to look up Taika Waititi's quote on the villain. Because I want to actually read it and then ask you if you believe that that fell through. Let's see here. Gosh, I felt like I saw a bunch of headlines, but I never actually saw the. Okay, yeah, this is his quote. He says, "Gore is the most sympathetic villain Marvel has had so far." The director added that the main Love and Thunder antagonist also tested the highest out of any villain that Marvel's ever had. I don't know what that means. Tested the highest out of any villain Marvel's ever had.
I'm guessing that's from test screenings.
Okay. How do you think he ranks as a villain in terms of depth, in terms of power set and consistency and earned factor? How do you think he fits?
He might be the creepiest Marvel villain that we've seen. The scene with him
definitely had some creepy shots. Yeah,
the scene with him and the kids in the cage was a scene that won me over with him. But as far as I get the sympathetic angle, I can see that. I'm trying to rank him in the Thor movies, at least. I think he's the best of the Thor villains. Like, Loki is Loki and is going to Loki all over the place. Hela was good, but she was just out for revenge. And to hell if I still don't understand what the Dark Elves were trying to do in Dark World. Love Christopher Eccleston, but I still don't get it. But I think he's probably the best villain of the Thor franchise.
Perhaps. Yeah, the Thor franchise, limiting it to just that. There were some creepy shots of him. The light play on his face, how his eyes sometimes lit up before his face.
His eyes in the black and white were eerie. Like, I really enjoyed how they did that.
When he showed up to New Asgard and came out of the darkness in his, you know, zombie-esque type look, his sheets, cloak and everything, it did look cool. But again, on second watch and just thinking about it over the weekend, just like I wanted to see Jane go from finding the hammer to becoming the Mighty Thor, I kind of wanted to see Gore from from the Oasis to this point, because we get a half a second of, there's other gods that are being killed, to this. And I'm like, I wanted to see it, you know, I wanted to see a little more progression of him. I feel like it was just, you know, he was weak, then he was powerful, then he was versing Thor. You know, there was no real buildup. I mean, I know we can't get Thanos level buildup, because that was over 20 plus films, but I wanted more.
The fact that Jamie Alexander is seventh billed in this film for playing Sif tells me that they filmed a scene with her fighting Gore and it got cut.
Even
just that, showing him with establishing that Sif is still alive outside of the Guardians distress call screens would have added more to her, like, not only her story but his. And just simple things like that would have made it, like, just fleshed out a little bit more. But
yeah, and again, it's a one and done villain. We're not going to get him anymore. I thought that there was a lot of mirroring in this film. I thought this film mirrored Ragnarok in structure, and that we got a villain in the beginning, then Thor goes off on this distraction adventure, and then the film eventually comes back to the villain, where the villain isn't the primary, you know, Hela wasn't the primary driving force of a bunch of the middle act of Thor Ragnarok, just as gore is it the driving force of the middle act of Love and Thunder. So I felt it mirrored that. I felt Gore himself kind of mirrored Wanda almost in Doctor Strange, in that I see a lot of people suggesting that, you know, every bad decision he makes is only because of the sword, and that he's merely he's more of a victim than he is a villain. I don't agree with that, and I know we differ on that final scene. I thought it was just jarring that he was like the villain the whole film, and then, oh, Thor, take my kid, you know, like, look after him. I feel like it could have been hinted at or built up, had some foundation throughout the film, if he would have been like, yeah, Thor, you are different, but I'm still going to kill you anyway, because I have made this. I feel like if there was some more interaction at that point to where he did kind of tried to fight the sword a little bit, mm-hmm. and say that you are different than the other ones. And he did have that one line that, oh, you went to the gods and they denied you. We had that in common. But that wasn't enough for me to be like, oh, yeah, he's just going to ask Thor to raise his kid. You know, I felt, again, it's a matter of depth. I inject all the comedy you want, but I feel like there was a lot of plot, a lot of grounding that this
a lot of meat
story could have used. Yeah, a lot of meat to justify some of the choices in the film.
Yeah. But that being said, I like we're picking at the bone here. I still had a good time watching this. Like, it's not a perfect film. I stand by that. But I think it's a fun watch. If you like the Thor movies, you like Taika Waititi. I'm curious how they're going to bring Thor back. Like, at the end of the film, it says Thor will return. Mm. I don't know when or where, but he's coming back, so.
I am, too. I perhaps this will grow on me like Ragnarok did. I will leave the, because I did see them 2 days. I saw both showings 2 days in a row.
Yeah.
And perhaps with time, I am sure that my forgiveness and leniency towards the Dark World is more based on nostalgia and not because there's something in that film that deserves to be forgiven and embraced. But I am interested to see where we go from here with Thor, because this reminds me of, like I said, Infinity War. After Taika Waititi redefined, evolved, changed, edited Thor's whole persona in Ragnarok, I was like, what is he going to be like in the next Avengers film? I think one of the worst, outside of the Dark World, I think one of the most boring times I've ever seen Thor was in the first Avengers movie. Like, he was just dull in that film. It felt, you know, where I loved Thor and how different it was. Once you put him in the same room as Tony Stark, I was like, he just doesn't fit. He sticks out like a sore thumb.
But the highlights of Thor in that film are the fun moments that he has. Like,
sure.
Loki may be deranged, but he is my brother. He killed 75 people. He's adopted.
Yeah.
Like, there's the Thor that we eventually get to is there. It took them so long to figure out. And I think that's why for Dark World, they brought in Joss Whedon to inject a little bit of humor into the film with Loki and Thor. And I think that eventually got us to Taika's version of Thor. Cause there's definitely no humor in Thor in Age of Ultron outside of the party scene. So
true. But if you did watch the evolution of Thor in just the Avengers films, he does evolve into a better character.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he is better in Age of Ultron than he was in Avengers. And by the time we see him in Infinity War, he is a full character. But I do feel like like when Taika is not directing him and involved in the direction of his character, he has a little more maturity. He has a little more weight. And then when he's back under Taika, then he's more clumsy and he's more smiley and he's more whimsical. So when is the next time we're going to see him? Are we going to see him in another Taika film? Are we going to see him in a, is there going to be parts of him in the Guardians film where he can be more funny?
Yeah.
Or is he going to be in an ensemble piece where he has to be serious again, you know? And then after a while, it's going to be like every other film he's funny and then he's not funny. And which one do people like the most?
Yeah. Which brings up a good, something that I haven't talked to you about. So we're going to figure this out right now.
Okay.
Marvel has announced they're going to be at San Diego Comic-Con.
Mm, that's right. That's right. Which is a big deal because they weren't.
They weren't going to be.
Last 2 years or just last year?
They
weren't last year.
They were
sure.
They were there at 2019. That's where they announced Natalie Portman coming back as Jane Foster. And then they weren't at the last few years because of the COVID cons not being exactly what Comic-Con used to be.
Had it in 2020. Yeah. No. I don't think they even had a physical con. I don't know if they
didn't have a physical. They had the virtual cons. But Kevin Feige has said that the future of the MCU will be made more clear in the near future. So either that means they're going to be making big announcements at Comic-Con this year, like they did in 2019, or they're going to save it for D23, which is coming up, I believe, in August. Maybe we should talk about it when that happens, but as the Victims and Villains Marvel correspondents, just reactions to their panel as it happens or afterwards, like a catch everyone up.
We definitely should.
Yeah.
I saw an article last month from Deadline that says Marvel's Kevin Feige drops hints about Phase 4 and studio's next big saga. And he said, as we're nearing the end of Phase 4, I think people will start to see where this next saga is going. I think there are many clues already that are at least apparent to me. Well, of course, you reign supreme of where this whole saga is going, but we'll be a little more direct about that in the coming months to set a plan so audience who want to see the bigger picture can see a tiny, tiny, tiny bit more of the roadmap. I mean, if anything, I can see him coming up on stage and being, look, guys, this has been the whole plan. We had a super structured 1-3 phases for the Infinity Saga. We always meant for 4 to be kind of the filler saga, to give you more one-off, less connected films. But once Phase 5 starts to kick in, then that's really the next saga, and you'll see little hints in Phase 4. But Phase 4 was always meant to be this filler thing. I can see that being said, because he's saying we're ending we're nearing the end of Phase 4. And a lot of people keep saying, when is Phase 4 going to kick off? You know? So, yeah.
I mean, to be fair, Phase 4 has had a lot go against it, whether it's from Disney's own doing or just the world that we live in. I like to think that everything is just building up to the Guardians of the Galaxy holiday special, but that's just me. There's a lot more Phase 4
coming.
Yeah, there's a lot more Phase 4 coming up in the near future. So I'm excited to see what they talk about. But what I do know that we will be talking about here soon is this week. I don't even know what day it is.
Is it Wednesday?
Wednesday, the Ms. Marvel finale drops. So Josh and I will be back in the podcast feed here soon to talk all about season one of Ms. Marvel, because I don't know if it's going to be a one-off series or not. So I'm saying season one, the full season of Ms. Marvel.
Not to get too deep into it, but I've heard a lot of people say, oh, I'm just going to binge this when it's done, or I haven't been I've seen a lot of coverage kind of lax on this. Yeah. Have you watched it weekly, or have you felt the need to watch it weekly?
I was watching it weekly. I'm all caught up on it, but Saturday night I started binging it again, like just to rewatch it for our podcast. And I was like, yeah, this does work better as a binge. And I think part of that is, and we'll talk about this more when we talk about it. Part of that is they released this against Kenobi. Like it dropped the same days. And like, I don't understand why. Like, I think that made it hard for me to concentrate, because I'm just like getting over like the awesomeness of Kenobi every day I'm watching it. I'm like, oh, wait, what happened now? Okay.
Well, and you know, the counter argument would be, well, these are two different franchises. Yeah, but they're still competing against each other on the same network. Although, to be fair, I think the only reason I did watch it week to week initially was because it was on the same day as Kenobi. Like, had it not been on the same day, that was the other weird thing. Not only was it releasing at the same time as Kenobi, but on the same day as Kenobi.
Mm-hmm.
That was like, at least give them different days of the week. But to be fair, that's the only reason why I watched them every week, was because I was reminded every time I logged in for Kenobi, oh yeah, the new Miss Marvel episode's out. So I would then watch Miss Marvel right after Kenobi. So I've been watching it week to week too, and I'm excited to talk to you about it
when
it's done.
Yeah, I'm excited. I'm going to try to finish my rewatch of it. I have an episode and a half to get caught up on. But I also have to, like, as soon as we end this, I'm going to go watch Better Call Saul. So.
Oh, me too. Yeah. I'm so happy it's back. I'm stoked. I love that show so much. And
Well, I think on that note, we both want to go watch Better Call Saul. So,
that's our final thing for the review.
Yep. Go watch Better Call Saul.
Is the next, real quick though, is the next Marvel film Wakanda Forever? Or is there a film?
Wakanda.
Okay, so we don't have a Marvel film until November.
Correct. We will have Ms. Marvel this week. Which day are we going to go live for that?
Are we going live this week? Or I mean,
I'm on vacation next week.
I'll make it work. Okay, I'm on vacation. So we got to make it work.
Yeah.
Wednesday
or Thursday works for me. Like, whatever works for you. We'll figure it out.
Yeah, it'll be one of those days. I don't know my conflicts yet.
So. Yeah, coming up before that, though, we have, before Wakanda Forever, we have She-Hulk.
That's right. She-Hulk.
Werewolf by Midnight. Special Halloween. There's a Halloween special coming out, directed by Michael Giacchino, which I'm super pumped about just for that aspect. And then I don't know if Secret Invasion is this year or not.
Oh, it can't be. If it is, they're being quiet about it.
I mean, they've been filming it, so they've been filming it for months. Yeah. So,
do you think we'll get a San Diego Comic Con is on the horizon? It's this month.
Yeah.
Do you think we'll get what's the likelihood? A second She-Hulk trailer? Well, a trailer, because the first one was just a teaser, or the first teaser trailer for Wakanda Forever, or both?
If we don't see a trailer for Wakanda Forever, I'll be surprised, because I think that's the point where you announce, like, this is how we're moving forward with Black Panther without Chadwick Boseman. Like, that's the best place to do it. Like, if you just release an article in, like, the Hollywood Reporter, that's like lackluster and...
But I think amongst your peers at Comic-Con,
Hall H with the crowd, like telling everyone this is what we did, and paying tribute to Chadwick Boseman in that way, I think is the best way to go about that. I think we'll get a trailer for that. I wouldn't be surprised if we got a glimpse at Guardians 3, because just in my research here, I saw James Gunn replying to tweets about Marvel at Hall H, like, oh really?
Well, if all we get is Wakanda Forever, I'll be happy, because I am so intrigued. I think everybody's on pins and needles about how they're going to do that. I think with Olivia, who am I thinking of? The Woman King, just coming out, the trailer with Viola Davis, starring in The Woman King. I don't know if you've seen that trailer.
I have not.
But it is an epic trailer. And the whole time watching that, I'm like, Wakanda Forever is going to have to go up against this? Like, it looks legit. And yeah, it immediately made me think of the first trailer for Black Panther and how incredible it was and how everybody was like, holy shit, this is going to be insane. I am just antsy to see the reaction to the first trailer of Wakanda Forever with everything surrounding. I wish that it wasn't having all that stuff weighing down on it, but you can't deny that it is. And so that is my most intriguing thing Marvel related for the rest of the year, is what that film's going to be, because it's got a lot weighing it down, and I'm sure they're putting their best foot forward, and I just want to know what that is.
Yeah, I'm excited for it. I wish I was going to be there, but no, don't have that kind of money.
Marvel needs to stop being assholes and come to New York Comic Con, because we're going to be we're there. Yeah. We're at New York Comic Con the other side, and it's just as big. And come on, Marvel, stop being assholes about it.
Like, I'm sure you'd probably shut down the booth for the day and just go to the Marvel panel.
I learned my lesson with Ghostbusters, so you know, or hire somebody to fill our spot. Yeah.
All right. I think that does it for our review of Thor: Love and Thunder and a preview of everything coming up Marvel. On that note, we are going to go watch Better Call Saul. So, in the words of Dr. Fraser Crane, good mental health. We will see you later this week.
See ya.